Hey everyone, Eric here. Just before we get to today's show, I want to let you know that we're offering our podcast listeners a special 20% lifetime discount to the China Africa Daily Brief. Now that's the newsletter that Kobus and I produce every day that provides the most comprehensive digest of everything China's doing on the continent and now increasingly throughout the global south. In addition to the newsletter, you'll also get full archive access to the website and the China Africa Experts Network as well. To get that discount, just go to ChinaAfricaProject.com/subscribe and use the promo code podcast at checkout. Once again, that's ChinaAfricaProject.com/subscribe.
The China in Africa podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg. The ACRP aims to improve the quality of reporting on Africa-China relations through reporting grants, workshops, and other opportunities for journalists. More information at africachinareporting.co.za and our dedicated training website at africachinatraining.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China in Africa podcast, a proud member of the Seneca Network from SubChina. I'm Eric Olander, and as always, I'm joined by Kobus van Staden, the senior China-Africa researcher at the South African Institute of International Affairs in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good afternoon to you, Kobus.
Good afternoon.
Kobus, today we're going to revisit the issue of race relations in China. Now, this has been a topic that we have been covering over the past almost, 1-2 years now, and it's come up repeatedly going all the way back to last year and what happened in Guangzhou, but then also prior to that, there was the CCTV Spring Gala performance earlier in 2018. And then again this year, there was another Spring Gala performance where once again, blackface was used. Now, it sparked, all of these incidents sparked a really robust conversation around the world about the issue of race relations in China. But one of the most interesting things, Kobus, is that the conversation really lacked a very strong Chinese voice in that discussion. So much of it was framed by perspectives in Africa, in the US, in Europe, and we really haven't had a very strong Chinese perspective on this, historically speaking. What we got out of the Chinese were these very generic, broad platitudes of there is no racism in China, there is no discrimination in China, and that's the end of it. And so much of it then fed into the current tensions between the United States and China, the Chinese government suggesting that the United States and Western media was trying to drive a wedge between China and Africa. And of course, that then brought the conversation to a standstill. So today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about China-Black relations, but from a very different perspective. But Kobus, the conversation today, as far as you have seen it so far, and the discourse that we've seen today, hasn't really, again, accentuated some of the deep historical context that's been missing from this discussion.
Yes, I mean, you know, in the first place, the way that Western people see issues like blackface, for example, is obviously located strongly in Western histories, and the way that this kind of expression has been used to denigrate people and to hurt people's feelings, and that is a very powerful perspective, among others, because obviously Western. Through colonialism, that those systems have showed up in lots of places and shaped many people's lives. But they are, China has its own whole set of issues around race and its own whole set of thinking about race. And I think it becomes very easy for the one to kind of cover over the other one.
We wanted to get a deeper perspective on this, more than what we've seen to date. And last summer, about last August, there was a post that was published on the Chinese social media network Weibo, which talked about anti-black racism on the Chinese social media network Weibo. And it was a very in-depth analysis of all of the virulent, nasty, disgusting anti-black racism that has been allowed to flourish on this particular social media network. And it's fascinating because it generated an enormous response online. It was written by a group of anonymous scholars. Now, these scholars went unnamed in part because they were concerned about retribution online. Chinese social media is, like, I guess, pretty much everywhere, a very, very tough place to be. And so these scholars were concerned that if they published their names or their affiliations or their institutions, that they would suffer severe consequences. Later, that same group of scholars then published a condensed version of that report in English on our website, and you can find it in the show notes. Again, it's entitled Anti-Black Racism on the Chinese Social Media Network Weibo. And we have invited a group of scholars in various forms you're going to hear today in the show to join us. Now, because of concerns about their security and their safety, we have respected their request to keep them anonymous. So all of the voices today from the various scholars that you're going to hear on this project are anonymous for their own safety, and not because of political reasons in China, but again, concern about retribution from trolls and from the mob online. So we have Scholar 1 and Scholar 2. Scholar 1 is our female guest who joins us on the line. A very good evening to you, Scholar 1.
Good evening to you, Eric, and good afternoon, Kovas. Thank you for inviting me.
And Scholar 2, a very good evening to you as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening. Yeah, it's very nice to have such a conversation.
We're going to get into a lot of detail on this, and we have a lot of great perspectives from scholars from around the world in China and in other countries who have contributed and participated in this research project that you posted on Weibo. We're going to get your perspective. I think it's very important that we put the Chinese government position up first so that we can just really dispatch it. And so we want to make sure that we get it on the record. So this was an interview by Li Nan, the chargé d'affaires at the Chinese embassy in South Africa, who was commenting on what happened in Guangzhou last year during an interview with South Africa's public broadcaster SABC. And here he kind of repeated the oft-stated position of the Chinese government regarding discrimination and allegations of racism in China. And it's very important that we just kind of set this as a benchmark.
I want to make China's government's position very clear. That is, all foreign nationals in China are treated as equals. China rejects any differential treatment of them and also has zero tolerance for discrimination in any form.
Okay, we've heard that line a lot. That is, in fact, where most of the discussion on the Chinese side in these debates kind of began and ended. And that's one of the reasons that when we heard the discussions following the Spring Galas, following Guangzhou, they were very much dominated by narratives on race shaped in the U.S., Europe, and in Africa. And in part, we didn't hear much from what was going on in China. So, Scholar One, let's start with you. And I think before we get into our conversation on some of the details about Black Chinese race issues and also anti-Black racism in China and on Weibo, can you just, for our listeners who are not familiar with Weibo, give us a brief introduction about what this social media platform is? How does it fit within the matrix of all of the dozens and dozens of different social media platforms that are in China and how people in China use it? Just give us a brief introduction to Weibo.
I think the Weibo is more like the Twitter in the foreign countries, and it's similar in the format that you have a limitation of how many characters you can send each time. So there's less kind of like in-depth things like a blog or a long post sort of thing. It has like a lot of users in China. So I don't remember the exact number, but I think the majority of the population use it. Instead of like comparing to WeChat, which is more like for a WhatsApp sort of like, and also combined with other functionalities, Weibo is more just for like a discussion online.
And Scholar 2, before we get into our, again, we're going to get into the details. And Kobus, I want to make sure that you get your perspective here. But Scholar 2, can you give us an introduction to the paper that you wrote last August about anti-Black racism on Chinese social media and on Weibo in particular? And give us the highlights of what you found in that research project with your colleagues.
Yes, we actually began to write the article after we try to track the behavior of those, let me call them right-wing netizen or online racist Weibo users, and we use the crawlers, the open source crawlers, to grab their data and use them to do our analysis and further research. And so I cooperate with the Scholar One to finish this article, and we would like to publish it online and to have some influence to raise the consciousness of the public, to make them realize the problem is serious and we have to do something about it. So we actually spent some time trying to get some media to publish it, and finally we found out that maybe the best way is to actually publish on Weibo itself. So basically our article is an analysis from the perspective of gender and ethnic tension we can observe on the Weibo platform. So actually, we gave a brief overview of how these right-wing racists their accounts, how they operate on the Weibo, and what their discourse is like.
Can you, Scholar Two, give us an idea of what number, like roughly what number of accounts are involved? You know, obviously Weibo is a very big platform. So you know, like are we talking about a very small percentage of Weibo users, or are some of these issues cropping up among larger numbers of them?
Actually, I think maybe a much more larger numbers of accounts are having these racist attitudes, but for our analysis, we found that about 63 accounts, which is the most devoted racists in this perspective, that they've spent most of their energy doing this online hate speech and their attack on Africans and Muslims, etc. So actually the number is about 60 to 70 accounts.
Wow, that's not many. I would have expected it to be much more than that, but I guess it really highlights the fact that it doesn't take a lot for these messages to go viral, because I remember last year, or was it the year before, there was a discussion about the new permanent residency law that the Chinese government was putting online and asking for comment. It was a rather unusual statement because we don't actually hear the Chinese government often asking the public for their input on proposed laws. There was no reference whatsoever to Black people or Africans, and yet the discussion shifted to just awful racism and just, again, nasty comments that came out from people focused on Black people and Africans. So again, it just seemed more than just the 60 or 70, but I guess it also goes to the point that we want to emphasize as a disclaimer here that, again, what happens on extreme social media is not necessarily reflective of the society as a whole. That is the same in the United States, it's the same in Europe, it's the same in Africa, and it's the same in China. So I think that's a very important context before we get too deep into our discussion. What we're going to do now for the rest of the program is that Scholar One and Scholar Two have also worked with scholars around the world on this initiative, and they reached out to those various scholars to share some of their input and their thoughts on some of these issues. And it's absolutely fascinating. We're just going to run through a bunch of them. I've got five or six lined up here for you to listen to, and we're going to use that to shape our discussion. Okay, this first perspective, and there's no order that we're going to run these in, comes from a scholar who raises the critical issue that so much of the framing of race issues in China and elsewhere are often based on U.S. and to some extent even European experiences, which is not always very constructive in these debates. And we saw this in the aftermath of the Spring Gala and this the 2021 Spring Gala show, where there were discussions on Clubhouse, there were discussions online, and again, so much of it was framed in a US-European context. That's absolutely 100% understandable, given that people see this from their own historical experience. However, as you'll hear from this particular scholar, she really doesn't feel that that is helpful at all to understanding the situation in China, and here she explains why.
Global discussions of racism are often US-centric. This is problematic in that, first, experiences of racism specific to the US don't necessarily translate to other societies. And secondly, this US-centrism often leads to people elsewhere, like in Europe or in China, saying this is an American problem, or in the European case, a problem of the past, and thereby creating a sense of innocence in the construction of the national self-image. Now, coming back to the Chinese context, issues of race and racism in relation to contemporary Chinese society are unfortunately rather understudied, even though racial discourse and imaginations of the global racial hierarchy were really crucial to the construction of Chinese national identity at the turn of the 20th century. For example, the connection between national identity and the idea of the yellow race is still a very popular reference in media and public discourse, as well as in popular culture. And if we shift from the concept of race to that of racialization, you see that lots of discriminations in contemporary society against the migrant workers, against the ethnic minorities, against the people from lower social economic classes, driven by a particular understanding of development, modernity, and the advanced versus backwards binary, are racialized and racializing processes. Fortunately, this is changing as more and more scholars and activists are working to open up the conversation on race through research or through awareness raising and education, like the guests on this show who have been studying anti-Black racism on Weibo. I co-started a podcast, the Shicha podcast, last summer, also with this in mind, and our first two episodes were on race and racism in the Chinese context, which are so far still our most listened to episodes. And secondly, a quick note on extremist speech on social media. Racist, misogynist, ultra-nationalist, xenophobic discourses are highly visible on places like Weibo and WeChat. This has to do both with the architecture of social media platforms, which tend to amplify extremist speech, and to do with the censorship regime. These posts rarely get censored, as censorship on Chinese internet focuses on removing dissidents rather than abusive hate speech, and they're typically nationalistic and supportive of the current regime. The counter narratives from progressive forces like feminists, equal rights activists, labor activists, and so on, these critical voices often get censored. This in turn also makes extremist speech more visible to observers.
Scholar number one, can you help us better understand how the censorship works as best as you understand it? Let me give an example. I have a Weibo account, and the other day I was posting on it, and I wanted to reference a Wall Street Journal. And so I wrote the characters, "华尔街日报", and I posted it, and it didn't go through. And so I started taking out different words just to try and see what was the offending word. And sure enough, it was the Wall Street Journal. Took those characters out. It got posted. That's a sensitive word. What's so odd for those of us on the outside looking in is Wall Street Journal is a sensitive word that is blocked, okay? But you can say the most awful things about Black people on Weibo and it's not blocked. How is that possible and why is that the way it is?
There was actually like there was a website called China Digital Library, I think. They have collected like all the sensitive words for different social media platforms, and they are kind of different depending on the Chinese social media platform. I just want to like explain a bit what happened with all these accounts, like these 63 extremist racist accounts that we followed. After we wrote this article, we reported all of them on the Weibo platform as like hate speech, and like now that I checked yesterday, there was like the 13 of the 63 have already disappeared. The explanation was they got published, they got punished because they were saying the wrong things that's not allowed through Weibo. So Weibo did do something about this hate speech. However, there are some like extremist racist speech that's not censored by Weibo as well. We don't know exactly how the mechanism work, how do they choose which one should they censor and which one should they not. But I think one thing is probably depending on how many fans they have. Like the more influential it is, the more likely they're going to censor these accounts. Also, the other perspective, it's like some of these accounts are nationalism. They say a lot of like nationalism, patriotic rhetoric, and some of them are Han Chauvinism. So it's possible like the government or the platform want to take advantage of some of these nationalism like emotions for their good. So that's probably one reason why they don't deal with some of these hate speeches. And as the other scholar said, Weibo does censor some of the progressive voices, for example, families, like eco rights, some environmental protection things, some animal protection things, labor activists. So these things Weibo does censor as well. And also, like as he said, this is probably why the extremist voice seems louder, because as we mentioned, like the gender perspective is a big part of the racist. So if we have some like feminist accounts online, we could probably line up with them because they could join us in the anti-racist campaign or this online campaign as well. However, a lot of these feminist accounts are censored, so we couldn't find a lot of the alliance with these accounts. And also, like another thing I want to mention is the censorship. We should understand it not as not only as a government censorship, because a lot of them are the Weibo censorship. So it's like the platform is censoring itself before it gets to the government. So that's why each platform is different. Like the sensitive words for each platform is different because it depends on like the rules from the platform itself. However, it does like probably sometimes they overdo it because they don't want that to get to an upper level. And after we published this article, we have the CEO of Weibo forwarding our article, and his attitude towards our article is like, we are applying the Western terms in the Chinese context, which is not suitable. So we are putting the racism label on our Chinese context. So this is his attitude towards it. So I think it probably also shows somehow the attitude of Weibo, the platform, because he is a CEO. And another anecdote I want to mention here is like, because I was super curious about this issue, so I actually posted something quite racist on Twitter. And I was just wondering if they're gonna do anything about it. I was wondering how does like Facebook and Twitter deal with these things. My account was fine for half a year. And it's just like after half a year, by the end of last year, my account got deregistered. So like, I don't know how these platforms handle these things.
They're cracking down a lot more now on Twitter and Facebook, especially after what happened with Donald Trump. So there's no doubt there's less tolerance in the U.S. on some of that. Okay, so let's talk about how race intersects with other domestic populations in China. Now, for those of you not familiar with the racial breakdown in China, it's about 92-93% ethnic Han. And so there is a dominant majority population there. And oftentimes that majority population will also assign values on race depending on whether they're urban or rural. And in urban areas, one of the things that there is some overlap with is how the perceptions of race overlap with perceptions of, say, migrant labor. Let's take a listen to another scholar and talking about race and labor.
I think to understand anti-Black racism in China, we need to better understand the Chinese society. We need to understand how Chinese have traditionally viewed internal ostracized groups like rural migrants and ethnic minorities. As global as anti-Black racism is, Chinese draw from their own knowledge of the quote-unquote others that they are familiar with in their interpretation of Black people.
For example, urban elites in China view Africans in a very similar way as they do rural migrants. They describe both groups as lacking civility or 低素质. The two groups sharing of spaces in Guangzhou further strengthen this connection. These neighborhoods are eyesores to the local government and detract from the image of the global city that the local government is trying to construct. Here's another example. Why Africans in Guangzhou have captured so much attention and triggered such strong anti-black reaction across the country can at least partly be attributed to how Guangdong as a region is viewed traditionally. Since pre-modern times, Guangdong has been a source of economic development, but also a source of cultural and ethnic contamination. It's always an exotic place, which is reflected in Cantonese, quote-unquote bird-like language and their uncivilized eating habits. How people back in 2003 blamed SARS on Cantonese eating wild game was a good example. This understanding of the region fused seamlessly with global racial stereotypes of Africa and Africans. Africans are often portrayed as carriers of diseases and bringing chaos and degeneration to a culture. So Africans in Guangzhou not only invoke Chinese fear slash hate of Africans constructed by globally circulated racial stereotypes, but also valorize Chinese long-held fear of Guangdong as a source of contamination. So ultimately, I think it partly boils down to Chinese lack of understanding of diversity. China has always been a very diverse country, culturally, linguistically, and ethnically. But Chinese tend to think diversity is simply about, for example, Shanghainese loving Sichuan food, or Chinese appreciating black athletes, or enjoying dances by smiling ethnic minorities. That's why we have yet another gaffe in the Spring Festival Gala this year. But diversity is about letting non-dominant groups speak, not reducing them to cultural products to be consumed or speaking for them. So anti-black racism in China is really closely connected to the lack of understanding of diversity that is deeply rooted in the Chinese society.
So Scholar Wan, there's a lot of really interesting stuff in this quote. And one, is just about the fact of people just simply being migrants. I wonder to which extent, how is this affected by black residents in China who are fluent in Chinese versus those who are not? I'm basing this on, I lived in Japan for a long time, and one of the things that were frequently complained about by Japanese people about foreign people is that they're Japanese isn't good enough. So I was wondering whether fluency in Mandarin changes any of this.
I think language is a big issue. That's what's causing the discrimination or miscommunication happening in Guangzhou. I think from what we've seen online and what we heard from other people, an idea was if they speak like an individual, come to China and learn Chinese and speak Chinese fluently, it's welcome. But there are a lot of these people online don't want them to stay for a long time, or don't want a big group of these individuals. If it's one person integrated in the society, they're happy, but they don't want them to stay forever, and they don't want them to be replacing the Chinese population.
Support for this podcast comes from the Africa-China Reporting Project at the Wits University Journalism Department in Johannesburg. The ACRP provides reporting grants, workshops, and other professional development opportunities for journalists. Follow the ACRP on Twitter at WitsChinaAfrica or visit africachinareporting.co.za.
One of the other difficulties that emerged in the wake of Guangzhou and also after the Spring Gala Festival incidents, and you heard this in some of the official rhetoric, like what we heard from Li Nan at the top of the show, is there just really isn't a language for race and racial issues in China the same way that there is in other societies like Brazil, South Africa, France, the United States, where race has been an issue for centuries. And there's a whole ecosystem of linguistics to talk about race. The vocabulary of race is just not there in the Chinese language yet. And maybe it will be there, maybe it won't. But this linguistic issue is really the focus of our next perspective.
We started this study group called 黑色的读书会, literally translated as the reading group in black, in response to debates about anti-black racism and the Black Lives Matter movement among Chinese-speaking communities. Our founding members are young overseas scholars from mainland China who have been engaged in activism and whose research touch upon issues of race, Black studies, African studies, or other aspects of Afro-Asian connections. The reason we started this group is because being active in anti-racist efforts of different kinds, we felt the need of an intellectual and social space to empower ourselves, to bring our collective knowledge together, and to ground existing wisdoms from critical race theory, Black studies, and the history of Afro-Asian solidarity in the Chinese language and Chinese realities. Because oftentimes, when we try to discuss issues almost taken for granted in the United States or in Europe, we realize we actually lack the language or even the vocabulary to put it in plain Chinese. We realize we need to, in a way, reinvent the language we use so that our discussions about race and racism can be more organic. So basically, we are learning by translating. The first book we read together was Cedric Robinson's Black Marxism. And his concept of racial capitalism is a very powerful tool. It was especially useful in response to the quite mainstream critique of the Black Lives Matter movement in China, which considers race-based struggles as misled because they obscure class conflicts. In the Chinese cultural sphere, there isn't much critique of Marxism being Eurocentric, and also not much attention was paid to slave revolts or the black workers' struggles as anti-capitalist struggles. This is something we hope we are able to contribute to the public debates. Other books we read include Sadia Hartman's Scenes of Subjection, Vijay Prashad's The Darker Nations, and Ashim Mbembe's Critique of Black Reason, among others. We nominate these books ourselves, and we take turns to present what we read and ask questions we had while reading and to take notes of our discussion. What we strive for is a kind of academic activism in which we invest in each other in the process of reading, thinking, and sharing, in the hope that this collective labor will benefit the anti-racist cause in whichever discipline we are situated. Our community continues to grow in these past few months, and it now includes more young scholars and extended to, for example, artists and curators, and there's even African student in China who joined us. And I hope we are really building toward the vision of a new generation of Chinese scholars who learn from and contribute to anti-racist thinking and action.
Scholar Tu, it's really interesting for me, this kind of issue of kind of class versus race in this discussion. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that, and you know, because the from the perspective of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, you know, anti-racist struggle and class struggle was always woven together. It's like, it's all, you know, in South African kind of history, it's almost impossible to pull those two apart. So I was wondering, you know, kind of like what you make of that critique, that this idea that talking about racism actually obscures class struggle.
I think that in the context of South Africa, or you might say in the US, there's a very strong and clear case that you can see that the class factor is clearly plays a part in the racist discourse and racial formation. But I think in China, you might say that the ethnic minorities in the Chinese society, you might say that you can analyze in this direction, but it's still, in my own opinion, it's still not so easy to put it as totally a question of class. I would say that it's more like a mixture of economic factors and cultural and racial factors. There are many, many different contexts mixed together. And especially in the context of Africans in China, I think you can only say that Chinese may use the category of rural migrants to perceive those Africans, but you cannot say that African migrants really have a very clear class position in the Chinese society, because there are many African businessmen or students in China, and you cannot say they are workers in the Chinese society. It's more a question of perception rather than a social class question.
As somebody who has spent most of my adult life in between the United States and China, one of the things that I've noticed is that these are both majoritarian countries, in the sense that in the United States, it is the white majority that is at the top of the caste system. And then in China, there is a Han ethnic majority. And one of the things that's interesting, and you heard this from Donald Trump quite a bit, Donald Trump would often say that he is the least racist person in the world. And you often will meet white people in the United States who will vote on policies and for candidates who are very much racist, or they are want to protect the caste system the way it has been for hundreds of years. They are very adamant that they don't want their children to be in schools that are too diverse. And yet they will tell you with a straight face that they are not racist at all. In fact, that is one of the most hurtful insults that you can put to almost any American. And it's kind of surreal. And I find that in China, there's a very similar conversation. And it has to do with the fact that oftentimes when you are not exposed to people of different religion, ethnicities, you know, all of the different diversity that's out there, then you think it's normal what you think. And this is the perspective of our next scholar.
The word racism never struck me before the first time I studied outside China. Clicking the box of Asian under the race in hundreds of forms, I have never really thought deep about why there need to be such categories to divide people with their race, and why it is always such a big deal when it comes to race. I can never say enough about how fortunate and privileged I am to be the majority and so-called the first-class citizens in the country. I spent 2 years studying in an international high school in India. The school has students from more than 80 different countries. It is the first time I feel I'm different from the others. My friend, a brown girl, was born and raised in Kenya. She once told me how her family was forced to move out from Kenya just because of their race. She, being brown, threw her out of her own country. I was so shocked and frightened when I heard the story. My country is always the safest place for me to be. I couldn't help thinking how it is like to be never accepted or recognized just because the way you look is different. The word racism, discrimination are so easy to say, but it was so much heavier when it actually falls onto individuals. Sadly, racism is not a very well-discussed topic in China. In April last year, during the pandemic, I participated in Simon Lee, helping the foreigners, especially the Africans who were forced into quarantine in my city, Guangzhou. It brought my attention to the African community here. Suffering from finance, accommodations, and visa problems, being in a foreign land during pandemic is definitely not easy. Living in such harsh condition, people in the city pay little or even no attention. Hei Gui, a word with insulting connotation, was always heard when I tried to bring up the topic with my family. All they can see and think is how these foreigners ruin the city, crowd the traffic, and dirty the area they live in. There was time I was curious why we just don't talk about race. The superficial conclusion I arrive at is the lack of empathy. It's difficult to ask people to think when they never come across the terrible outcomes of ignorance. We live in a country dominated by one race. The difference in race is no need to be highlighted in our history and education. Being Asian plays minor influence in our everyday life. Not witnessing or experiencing, the topic of race definitely and slowly drifted away. There are definitely great value in raising awareness of racism in China. But I also understand it would take a long time for people here to really start to think and care. Celebrating the variety and difference begins from realizing who we are and what we are. Only when we truly feel the difference and understand what it meant for us to be Asian, will we begin to think deep about the role that race plays in the world.
It's interesting for me how there's such a strong division between the experiences of people who've traveled overseas or lived or studied overseas and those who are in China. Do you feel that that's a big dividing line that you're also seeing in the study, that people who have more experience of being in more mixed environments and also the experience of being a minority somewhere else, that they are generally more sympathetic to the situation faced by migrants in China?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think a lot of the people who are not exposed to a diverse cultural environment in China, like the same with most of how Chinese young people grow up, we are in a very Han majority environment, never met any minority groups or like people of other race. It's very difficult for us to have like sensitivity for the racial issues. Like during our volunteer activity during the Guangzhou incident, there was a group of volunteers starting a concert, and all of the people who joined them are Chinese who have never been to African countries, probably never overseas, but they just want to help out. At that time, there was an issue that they developed a poster for African concert, which is made of savanna and trees and animals. This is just their impression of Africa from like what we are exposed to in media in general. But they have a good will, like they want to help out, to help the communication between the Chinese and Africans in Guangzhou. But this poster offended the African community in Guangzhou a lot, because they think this means like Africans are barbaric or backward. This is what this poster means. So there was a big conflict in the group at that time. So just to highlight that it's very difficult to have this kind of racial sensitivity if you are growing up in a very mono-ethnic country or region where you don't have a very diverse environment.
Let's pick up on that theme in part because the COVID-19 pandemic in many ways has exacerbated that situation. I mean, some of the racial animosity, the ignorance, the misunderstandings between Chinese and Black people. And it's very important to say that it's Black people because it wasn't just Africans that were victims of discrimination in Guangzhou. Also, African Americans also suffered as well. So it wasn't just Africans, a very important distinction to make there. You know, and this question of what happened in Guangzhou and possibly elsewhere has really been further exacerbated by the fact that there's been a lot less day-to-day interaction between people. People have been at home a lot more over the past year. There's been a dramatic downturn in the amount of travel between the two regions, between China and Africa. And it's much more difficult now for Africans to get a visa to come to China and also for them to overstay visas. And there was this gray area that Professor Roberto Castillo has talked about in the past, that quite a few African residents lived in this gray area. But because of some of the heightened controls now that are in place because of COVID-19 and also enhancements in Chinese technology, it is much more difficult to live in that legal gray area. So less interaction, according to our next perspective, and this is our last voice that we're going to have on the show here, has led to more extremism online, because if you just don't see people or you know people from those different backgrounds, it's really a lot easier to denigrate them on social media.
I noticed some changes regarding discrimination and hate against Black people in China. especially during the corona outbreak in African community of Guangzhou. My friends and I initiated a volunteer activity to help Africans who were unable to receive social support during the outbreak. As we know, it was hard for them to find hotels or suitable houses because of China's strict community control measures and public prejudice. Some international news media have described this incident as institutional racism, thinking that the Chinese government is expelling black people, which is not the whole story. We communicated with some landlords, restaurant owners, police officers, and social workers at the time, and found that things were more complicated, many of which were caused by information asymmetry and lack of communication. I think the change that have taken place in Guangzhou or in Chinese social media is the disappearance of diversity. The first is the disappearance of ethnic diversity, and the second is the disappearance of social contexts. Here I want to emphasize the impact of the disappearance of social context. When we use the word, we not only need to consider the meaning of the language, but also the intention of the speaker and the different social contexts in which the dialogue occurs. Many offensive words such as lazy and trash have been spread on Chinese social media. These words are very horrible and harmful, and deepening the prejudice against Africans. When these words are used in a transnational business community, for example, when a Chinese and an African trader have a quarrel over business matters, we may not think that is racial discrimination. However, when the social context is transferred to an online platform, which is full of nationalism and racial discrimination discourses, the meaning of the language has changed. I think social media makes the meaning of these words more singular, narrow, and vague, because we can't really know the experience and intention of the person who said these words. These are no things that are framed into a single narrative of racial discrimination. I think this kind of singularity is not enough to summarize and understand the complex social interactions and interpersonal relationships we live in. Therefore, I hope that we can correct the ambiguity and reduce harm that may be caused by language structure by restoring the social context in which the dialogue occurs and by paying more attention to the daily interaction between people.
So, Scarlett, one of the issues that was raised by one of the earlier speakers was this issue of a certain idea of a racial hierarchy. And obviously this lies at the heart of European racism, and it lay at the heart of the whole colonial project as well. So I wonder, how do you see this kind of idea of a racial hierarchy emerging?
I would say that it really plays a major part in their thinking, I think. First, their attitude actually reflects that they have a strong idea of self-victimhood, that they think Chinese is always being despised by foreigners, by whites, and even by Africans and so many nationalities. And so in their discourse, they always have a strong sense that Chinese, and especially Han Chinese, are the victims and are the most discriminated in the world. But there's another perspective that China is actually rising in its international status. And you can actually sense that they also see themselves as putting themselves in a higher place on the racial hierarchy. And they might even think that China should be in the place of where Europe and the US occupy now. So they also adopt the perspective that Africans or other ethnicities like Muslims or even Southeast Asians are in the lower place on the social hierarchy and the Chinese would be higher. So they have such a strange mixture of ambiguous idea of this social hierarchy. This is what I found the most strange and interesting when I observe their discourse.
Scholar One, let's close out our discussion trying to bring all of this together. It's been actually a rather intense hour to think about all of these different concepts. And again, these are topics and a way of looking at race that personally, and someone who follows this very closely, I haven't seen very much in the discourse. Certainly in the mainstream media coverage of racial issues, it doesn't go anywhere near this deep. These have been some really insightful perspectives from the various scholars and yourselves. But help us now kind of try and tie this all together. What's the takeaway that you think people listening to this program, who've listened to all the perspectives, they've heard what you've had to say, they're going to read your article either in Chinese on Weibo or in English on our website. What's the takeaway?
I think one takeaway is just to understand like the racial issues in China is different from the US, for example, or European countries. So we have to like think about, for example, China as a minor ethnic country or non-multiracial country. When you are like thinking about this issue, you have to put it under that framework. So that's one issue. The other, I think, like from our own perspectives, like we have been trying to push more of these anti-racism activities. Like we formed different WeChat groups and discussion groups. We are seeing more and more these new like young people, the next generation, like some of them are like high school students, for example, trying to having a more progressive worldview and a more open mandate. They have a better understanding of the racial issues. Probably like the major cultural environment or the censorship regime, like these things in China is not going to change in the near future, and anti-discrimination like activism in China is not going to be very easy. But we can only hope like we have like more and more of these enlightened individuals or more progressive individuals and can gradually influence more and more people. That's my take on that.
The article is Anti-Black Racism on the Chinese Social Media Network Weibo. It's on our website. We also have a link to the Chinese language version that is much, much more in-depth, written by our two scholars. Once again, just to repeat that the reason why we kept the names and identities of these two scholars and all of the scholars who participated in today's show anonymous is not for overtly political reasons, but because of the what's called the human flesh search engine in China, which is the trolls and the mobs are very good at descending on people who they disagree with. And this race issue in particular has been quite volatile. So we respected the requests of Scholar One and Scholar Two to protect their anonymity. So unfortunately, normally at the end of the show, we provide people with contact information and social media. We can't do that today. But we did want to really extend a very gracious thank you to both Scholar One and Scholar Two for joining us today to help explain this and adding a lot of missing nuance in the discussion and for everybody to better understand the complexities of race relations in China and racial views. And so we also want you to extend on our behalf to the various scholars who've worked with you on this project and who contributed their perspectives, a really just a warm-hearted thank you so much for that. So thank you both for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric and Kobus.
Thank you so much, Eric and Kobus.
was, my head is spinning. I mean, there's just so much to process in everything that was said. And I'm so grateful for these scholars to take the chance to do this, because they were nervous to come on and have their voices. It's one thing to write something anonymously. It's another thing to have your voice. We altered the voices of the scholars who sent their files in, and you could hear that little telephone sound in it, because they too were concerned about their security and whatnot, because this is such a sensitive issue. But it's one that is really important that we really understand and go beyond the very simplistic narrative that, you know, that we've seen. Again, I hate to say the Western media, but it is in the English language, Anglophone international media, which was, there's racism in Guangzhou, so China's a racist country, and therefore that's it. That is ridiculous, because it's too complex, as we heard. It's too multifaceted. And this is only going to get worse, because as China continues to rise and become a world power, you're going to start mixing in, and we heard that in the themes today, the rise of nationalism, ethnocentrism, and this deep insecurity that runs through Chinese culture, which the Communist Party has nurtured for decades, about the century of humiliation at the hands of foreigners, whether it's the Japanese, the British, the Americans, and whatnot, and continues to foster that resentment towards foreigners, specifically Westerners and Americans right now. All of that is being put into a blender. And so these race and identity issues now in China are immensely complex. And it is so reassuring to me to hear that there are these amazing young scholars who are doing this kind of research and really pushing the boundaries within China. And I have to say that right now, race issues don't kind of brush up against political issues, but these young scholars are challenging the narratives of the Communist Party. Because as we heard from Li Nan at the beginning, the Communist Party, their line is super, super simple. There is no racism. There is no discrimination. We treat everybody the same. End of story. And now these young scholars are coming up and saying, wait, whoa, 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 that's not quite the story. So right now, it doesn't seem like it's brushing up against politics, but it feels like it can cross that line pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff gets politicized very quickly. What we're seeing at the moment is this very interesting debate happening in France, where a lot of kind of French establishment people are complaining about the use of American disciplines like critical race theory, and kind of accusing it of essentially kind of causing a decline in the, you know, in intellectual tradition in France. So it's not only China who's dealing with these issues and who frequently lacks the kind of vocabularies to discuss them. I think this is going to be a really big issue in the coming few decades. Like a while ago, just after the Spring Festival, I wrote an intro for our newsletter, in which I made the point that in a lot of ways the blackface incident in the Spring Festivals reminded me a lot of 1950s Hollywood film, where it was also this kind of projection of a very flattened world made up of stereotypes that is essentially there to welcome American power, you know. And in a similar kind of way, I think this kind of Spring Festival played into a similar kind of idea of these kind of flattened stereotypes of different people from different areas all happy to welcome China. And, you know, like, I think the reality of the race discussion is that it's a lot more complicated than that. And as China grows as an international actor, I think it's high time to start reckoning with how complicated it is, you know, because otherwise there's going to be trouble.
But the problem is, as you pointed out, in France, is that also the French borrow language from the United States. And that's a very contentious issue, because the French language is a national treasure. And so the importation of language into France is something that is highly contested. And as we heard, when they submitted this essay to the head of Weibo, he summarily dismissed it and said, these are Western concepts. These are not Chinese concepts. And that's another interesting parallel. And I think it's going to be difficult to broaden this conversation in China, in part because, as we heard from some of the experts tonight and some of the scholars, they are borrowing language and identity framings from the US and Europe and bringing them into China. And it will be a fight to mainstream that and to get it accepted. And so maybe it might be interesting, is rather than looking to the US and to Europe for this language. I'm wondering if South Africa and Brazil might provide a better model.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is, you know, anti-racism is always in conversation between different places. So South African anti-racism has been in deep conversation with the US, with Europe, with the Soviet Union, with China also. So, you know, yes, I think more cross-pollination is useful. But the thing is, both Brazil and South Africa, they bring a very specific racial histories to the table that aren't necessarily more easily applicable to Chinese realities than Western concepts. The great thing with Western concepts is they come out of these incredibly well-developed academic, you know, kind of structures or institutions where so much work is put into refining them. You know, so all of that kind of like long-windedness of that we complain about with scholars, that's what it brings to the table. It brings it incredible levels of like fine-grained nuance when you're talking about these things. And frequently there is no other way than simply doing the work of translating those concepts one by one into different languages, you know. It's happening from English into other places, but it's also happening into English from other languages.
And one of the points that I found most salient in the discussion was this idea of interaction. And when we lose interaction with people from different backgrounds, we lose empathy. And this is something that we're seeing in the United States as well as, for example, healthcare and education and fitness and all of these activities that once brought us into a public space with other people are now being done in the home. So you don't have to go to the supermarket anymore. You know, NetGrocer will bring your stuff to you, or Instacart will bring everything to you. You don't have to go to the gym anymore because you've got a Peloton at home. You don't need to go to the doctor because there's telehealth. You're not going to campus anymore because you're online with school. And even after the pandemic's done, a lot of these patterns may stay. And that will harden our attitudes. We're already seeing it to some extent. The fact that we don't interact with one another makes it easier to denigrate the other. That's also the case in China, where we're seeing the African population under considerable strain now in places like Guangzhou. The cost of living has been very high. There has been active discrimination against Africans and Black residents in Guangzhou. Also, it's almost impossible now to get a visa. And the new regulations that are coming down says you have to get a Chinese vaccine in order to get a visa. And not everybody has access to Chinese vaccines. So if I want to go to China from here in Vietnam, I'll have to get a Chinese vaccine. They don't have Chinese vaccines in Vietnam. So will that prevent me from going? The point is there's going to be less interaction, less friction between different cultures. The friction I mean is just rubbing up against one another, where you have that communication. And everybody's going to be in their corner. So I'm not convinced that we're going into a happy period on this, because I have a feeling that because social media inherently amplifies extremism, and because we're not interacting with one another, it's easier to denigrate the other. So that might be the short-term prospects that we face.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. We're going to see in the next few years a whole set of new kind of restrictive rules and apparatuses set, you know, put up by different countries to try and kind of restrict how people move. And I think that's gonna breed a whole new set of politics that we're gonna have to deal with. The thing with media, though, is that on the one hand, like I agree with you, social media does tend to favor these silos, but media as a whole is also an incredible repository of diversity. You know, like one of the things, I remember like being an early child, like a small child, in apartheid South Africa, and American media was an incredible kind of vision of a different kind of world, media as a resource for diversity, I think, shouldn't be underestimated. And this is why things like diverse casting and so on is incredibly important. It's like it's more important than simply representing one community to their country. It has transnational implications.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the show today. It was a tough show to produce in the sense of trying to make sure the security was taken care of and bringing the ideas together and kind of weaving in all of these different kind of strains that do overlap with one another, but at the same time are not always connected. It's a tough subject, and it's one of the things that we're going to continue to try and bring, but we were so excited to be able to bring a more nuanced Chinese perspective on these race issues that we have felt has been missing from the discourse and the discussion. It's also one of the things that we're going to try as best as we can, because getting Chinese stakeholders now to speak publicly to the international media is next to impossible. We extend interview request after interview request after interview request to Chinese stakeholders of all kinds, and we're just turned down. And it's not just us. It's not because of the China-Africa Project. It's because they don't want to speak to foreign and international media. So my journalist friends who work for mainstream publications say the same thing. And so we're struggling very, very hard to bring these Chinese perspectives, because we feel that without the Chinese voice in all of this, having a discussion about race or culture or politics or any part of the China-Africa relationship without a strong Chinese voice is something that's missing. So I thought today really went a long way to filling that void. We would love to hear what you think. These are contentious issues. We ask that you stay civil in the discussion because it is provocative. But we would love to have an exchange with you. Email us, eric@chinaafricaproject.com or cobus@chinaafricaproject.com. Share your perspectives with us. Let us know if you also want to request anonymity. We don't publish emails or anything like that, but we would like to have these kinds of exchanges because we think through this kind of dialogue, we can get to a place of better understanding. So that'll do it for this edition of the China in Africa podcast. Cobus and I will be back again next week with another show. Until then, for Cobus Van Staden, I'm Eric Olander. Thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Head over to facebook.com/China Africa Project to share your thoughts on today's show. Or follow the guys on Twitter. Eric's at Iolanda, and you can find Cobus at Stadenesk. For more information about the China Africa Project and to sign up for our free weekly email news brief, go to chinaafricaproject.com.